Sean Yoes, your host. Thank you for joining us for our first of 2 hours on this Friday. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at First Edition 889, and don't forget to like and follow us on Facebook at First Edition on WEAA 88.9 FM. Go to WEAA.org on our homepage for the latest podcast of First Edition, or subscribe to our iTunes podcast, First Edition. Also, hit me up on my personal Twitter account. The tag is at Sean Yoes. That is my name, S-E-A-N-Y-O-E-S. Or go to my Facebook page. If you have information, insight, or breaking news you want to share with me, I will share it with the people unless you don't want me to. And, of course, I won't do it. Coming up, second hour of the show, it is the world-famous happy hour. 2-for-1 on the world-famous happy hour. We sit down, when I say we, I mean myself, and Patrick Scientific of the Audio Infusion sit down with house music diva Evangela, play some of her music. Then, after that interview, Patrick goes live, plays live house music all night long on the World Famous Happy Hour. 2-for-1 on the World Famous, coming up at 6 o'clock. A little bit later in the first hour, we will talk to two reporters. Ashley Banks will talk to, she's a news anchor and host of Race in America for RT America. We'll talk to her about some of her latest stories, including racial turmoil in the city of Lisbon, Portugal, as well as the nomination of Christopher Wray as the next FBI director of the United States. Then we'll also talk to the Afro's J.K. Schmidt about his story. We'll drill down a little bit deeper. We'll drill down a little bit deeper on J.K. Schmidt's story about the University of Maryland. He'll be in the studio. But before we get to those two, Kamal High is in the studio with me.
I am.
Are we sure?
It does not sound like it.
Keep talking. There we go.
Yes, I am in the studio.
All right. Everybody's in the studio.
It's all very exciting.
It is very exciting. Kamal High is the managing editor of the Afro newspaper. Kamal, welcome back.
Thank you, Sean. And might I say congratulations to the new Baltimore editor for the Afro American.
I thought you were going to say the new world heavyweight champion of the world.
You said it
like that.
Well, listen, editor of the Baltimore section, that is a heavyweight championship position.
That is true.
It's not.
When you said new, I thought I was going to raise my hand.
Yeah, it's, you know.
Put the belt around my waist.
Not for freshmen, strictly linemen.
It is definitely not for freshmen. Thank you. I appreciate that, though. So let's talk about some of the stories in the pages of the Afro, the number one black newspaper in the world. This front page photo, it's only for the music junkies.
Yes, it is a picture of a very large mural that went up in Chicago of King of the Blues, Muddy Waters.
Now, people would, I love Muddy.
Yes.
There's probably a battle there. B.B. King probably get a few votes.
Listen, I mean, you know, B.B. King is no slouch.
No.
But, I mean, did B.B. King have a song called Hoochie Coochie Mama?
No.
Did he have a song called I'm Your Backdoor Man?
No, he didn't.
So I always love sort of old songs that are risque because people always go, oh, you know, back in our day, songs were much cleaner. No, they weren't.
No.
They were saucy.
There was some rough stuff. There was some rough stuff back in the day. But No Muddy the word pioneer is tossed around a lot, but he was, as far as that music is concerned, really a genius when you think about how he, I mean, foundational stuff he did as a blues musician and guitar player.
Yes, foundation of rock and roll and parts of hip hop.
No doubt about it. Another story we have been literally following for years. closing arguments in this HBCU equity lawsuit.
Yes. On Thursday, Judge Catherine Blake, sort of heard the final arguments in this long-running dispute that alumni and supporters of the Maryland's four HBCUs filed against this state, alleging essentially segregation, that the state has segregated African-American universities by duplicating all of their important and significant programs in other traditionally white institutions here in Maryland.
Duplication and shorting them fiscally.
Yes.
I mean, there's no other way around it. For decades, have not received proper funding. It's plain to see.
Yes, I mean, it's fascinating because Judge Catherine Blake essentially said, okay, everyone make your best offer. And the coalition representing the alumni and supporters of HBCUs came back with essentially a number that was in the billions and saying we would like programs and buildings associated with some of the traditionally white institutions move to some of the HBCUs. And the state of Maryland's offer amounted to here's a couple $1 million. Take that and be happy.
I mean, I keep hearing the commentary from many people that Maryland is one of the most regressive, and indeed, I mean, in the minds of more than a few people, one of the most racist states in the United States. I don't know how the state takes the positions they take on some of many of these issues, the most prominent one maybe being the HBCU lawsuit, and not have that resonate with a lot of people.
Well, I mean, perhaps we can have a long discussion about it, but right by the statue of Robert E. Lee in Stonewall Jackson, a few blocks from the Afro-Americans headquarters
exactly,
here in Baltimore.
Exactly true. I mean, all four of those monuments are like right along the Charles Street corridor, which is the main street.
Yes.
Literally in Baltimore City.
Yes.
It divides east and west.
Yes, it's almost like the city's proud of those monuments.
Right. Yeah, let's put them right there on Charles Street.
Yes.
We will get into more about the city's Confederate monuments when we get to the Baltimore section. But let's we've got to talk about the Cosby trial. being obscured by so much, but still he's there. When all of those accusations broke, there was no bigger headline than the one of Cosby's sexual abuse accusers.
Yes. I mean, I've been reading some of these stories coming out of that trial. And, today or yesterday, they read his deposition in which Mr. Cosby discussed how and why he gave young women some sort of medicine to help them relax.
Yeah.
And then the young women say he sexually assaulted them. It's harrowing stuff.
Yeah, harrowing indeed. They called it back in the Playboy Mansion, Slipper or Mickey.
Yeah, Spanish Fly,
yeah,
I believe, is also a funny side note. Bill Cosby has a long extended riff on Spanish Fly on one of his 1970s album.
It's so ironic and sad and just egregious, horrible. I mean, I don't know what other words. It's nothing funny about drugging women.
No.
And trying to assault them and assaulting them. And it seems clear.
Allegedly.
I'm saying exactly. It seems clear that he partook in this type of activity for decades. But I guess that's what the trial is all about.
Yes. I mean, right before the trial began, Bill Cosby was giving interviews where he said that he was looking forward to coming back to doing stand-up. And I just sort of, I read that and I shook my head.
Bill, I don't see
it. I mean, there's a sizable part of the African-American population that supports Bill Cosby and says that, you know, why didn't these women come forward at a much earlier date? Why did they wait so long? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, maybe there is an audience. I mean, I don't see it, but hey.
Bill, I don't see stand up in your future, bro.
No.
I don't see it. I don't see it.
I mean, unless he was on presumably if he gets convicted, you know, once he was done with prison, unless he was on like I Apologize to America kind of tour. And even that.
Yeah. No. Let's go to the archive section. I think this is really an important story that we go back into the archives, given the fact that there have been several nooses discovered around Maryland, D.C., and Virginia. One actually in the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, at the Smithsonian.
Yeah.
Yes. And so, you know, because of that, we went back into the archives for a story from March 23rd, 1935 in Sladen, Mississippi. And it is an eyewitness account of a horrific lynching of a young black man accused of killing a white man. And what's fascinating about it, besides just sort of the fact that back in the day, people would hold lynchings and invite people to them. They would invite the media. They would invite sort of their friends and neighbors. It was almost a public spectacle. Yeah, it was almost like a party-like atmosphere.
It was. They would have barbecues. They would take pictures. They would cut the victim's body parts and mail them as souvenirs. Hold them, keep them as mementos. This was the behavior of these individuals, and for people to take a noose and bring it to the Smithsonian or place it in the Smithsonian. First of all, how do they do that? But to think that it's something, some sort of a joke or something light, it absolutely isn't. And this archive story reminds everybody what the noose really represents.
Yes. I mean, you know, it's just despicable to sort of do that sort of thing. Although, I mean, I have to say, you know, you spend enough time on the internet and there is a certain strain of the internet that sort of sees proclaiming racism as being ironic. And you know, I just sort of shake my head at those people because it's sort of like, you know, if you go around pretending to be a jerk and saying like, well, my character is a jerk, but it's not really me. No, the answer is that you're just sort of acting like a jerk. And I say the same to the people sort of who embrace this ironic racism. It is a strange and weird strain of the internet.
Yeah, let's go to the DC section. It is a strange and weird strain of the internet. The DC section, this is a disturbing story. Fake ice flyers have been made their way around Southwest DC.
Yes, this appears to be the work of, you know, some clearly
some ironic racists.
I wouldn't be surprised. Or these might just actually be people who think that they are doing good. I don't know. Or that they enjoy scaring people. Yeah, so there are flyers up in parts of DC so essentially saying like ICE is coming for you, you know, get out now. And, you know, you sort of think, like, who's got the time to sort of sit around and make fake ice flyers and then take time out of your day to go up and tape them up on various light poles and street fixtures?
I don't know. Internet trolls? I don't know.
Yeah.
So, Marion Barry, his 1978 campaign, there is now a digital archive of Marion Barry's 1978 breakthrough campaign.
Yes, there are firsthand interviews with participants, volunteers, campaign workers, and it's all being housed at George Washington University. And it was driven in large part by D.C. Council member Anita Bonds, who's a Democrat at large. And so this was Barry's historic campaign and sort of his emergence on the scene as eventually what would become mayor for life.
Absolutely. Absolutely. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yeo, your host. I'm in the studio of Kamau High, the managing editor of the Afro-American newspaper. We're going through some of the top news stories of the week directly from the pages of the Afro, the number one black newspaper in the world. Some insider politics here on the DC page. The resignation of Arrington Dixon.
Yes. You know, Arrington Dixon is the former D.C. Council chairman, and he stepped down. And it's really sort of left a vacuum of power. And we all know that power abhors a vacuum. So the race to replace him is one that is in full-throated scramble right now.
Story by veteran D.C. writer James Wright.
Yes.
let's go, excuse me. To the Baltimore section, my favorite section.
Actually. Yes.
Now even more so, I guess.
Yes. Now you starting in this next week's paper, it'll be under your editorship.
Yeah.
What do you have planned for the people?
I'll tell them.
Yeah.
a lot. Let's go to J.K. Schmidt's story, and I think that it's important that we continue to report and to be clear, really keep the pressure on the University of Maryland to act vigorously and with urgency in the wake of this murder of this young man.
Richard Collins III.
Yeah.
Yes. So J.K. Schmidt actually went out to the University of Maryland College Park campus out in essentially Prince George's County. And he talked to not only students, but professors and leadership, because the University of Maryland, in the guise of President Lowe, has put forth a 5-point plan to sort of deal with what is perceived as the racism on the campus. And parts of it include $100,000 to sort of help with diversity efforts and sort of beefing up those things. And so we wanted to talk to people about what the and take the temperature of life on campus there.
We're going to have J.K. Schmidt here in the studio a little bit later to drill down even further on this story. But one of the suggestions that I saw from one of the people that he talked to is that these people who are caught practicing white supremacy, racism, racist acts, whatever, should be expelled, expulsion, get out for life. Lowe has been his reaction has been disappointing to a lot of people, tepid in the minds of many, and that has to change. We have two budget stories, city council budget stories, in the Baltimore section. One by Jennifer Wright.
Yes, this one looks at sort of an overview of all of the cuts that the city council has proposed to Mayor Catherine Pugh's budget. And the second story looks sort of specifically at the $2 million that is being targeted to be taken from the Baltimore City Police Department. As we all know, the Baltimore City Police Department takes up a large percentage of the city's budget, particularly due to their overtime.
Absolutely. Stephen Janis, our colleague with The Real News, wrote that story on the police budget. And specifically, I think it was on time in the sense of trying to gauge the direction of the council. I mean, is this something that's just symbolic, or mark a change of trajectory as far as budget priorities is concerned? That is the question, and we will continue to follow.
Yes, I believe there is a vote on Monday.
The final vote.
Yes, the final vote. Yeah. So we will see. And then, of course, we will see if Catherine Pugh accepts that or if she decides to veto it.
Yep. Yes. And also a story here about a man, Clyde Johnson Smith, who was broke some racial barriers within the Baltimore City Fire Department.
Yes. He died at the age of 84, and he was the first Black Academy instructor with the Baltimore City Fire Department. He was born in South Carolina and segregated Greenwood, South Carolina. And he came to Baltimore as a young man and went to Frederick Douglass High School, where he played football and ran track. He was in the Army, where he served as a paratrooper. And then he sort of took a winding road to the fire department. He went to Morgan State and then wound up and eventually made his way to the fire department, where he was one of the people who helped form the Vulcans.
Vulcan Blazers, yeah.
Which is the organization for Black firefighters.
Absolutely. And it was supposed there was a meeting up in New York, in 1969, him and 10 of his colleagues, mm-hmm. and they formed an international Black fire union. So, yes. Rest in peace, Clyde Johnson Smith. I guess I should talk about my column.
Yes. It's your right as Baltimore editor.
It is. These Confederate statues.
All four of them. So many. I mean, four is just such a, couldn't be bad enough that there's one.
Right.
But four.
Maryland was officially a Union state.
Yes.
Yet we have four Confederate statues, and there's allegedly one Union statue somewhere in the city. I don't know where it is. I have no idea.
We should track it down and find it.
Yeah. One of the things I mentioned hypothetically, even if Mayor Pugh woke up one day and said, you know what, I'm going to blow up all four of these damn statues, she couldn't do it. And she can't really do it because there are protocols, institutions in place that really forbid that from happening. Until there is a certain process, a bureaucratic process that has to happen. There's fiscal restrictions. It's just incredible that a predominantly Black city with a Black mayor, a majority Black city council, has to continue to watch New Orleans in the heart of Dixie, mm-hmm. statues gone. After the Charleston massacre, they take the flag from the State House in South Carolina under a Republican governor. But we just cling to our our guns and our statues.
Yeah, I mean, the, you know, those Confederate monuments, those are historic things. Those are things that, you know, we should all sort of think about and remember. But I just wonder if the proper place to remember them is on our streets as opposed to, say, a museum.
Especially after they're erected in the 1940s.
Yes, long years, after the Civil War.
Almost 100 years after the Civil War.
So. Long after the Confederacy had lost the Civil War.
Some people don't seem that they quite got the memo that they actually did lose.
Yeah, that's a weird thing. Yeah. You know, the people who were sort of like, oh, Confederate heritage, it makes you go, you are supporting traitors.
Yeah, exactly. Treasonous dogs. Yes. Basically. Let's go to the picture page while we have a minute left. 1 minute left. Where is it?
It should be on the back of C1.
Lovely photos. This great... Maryland salutes Perrin J. Mitchell, one of the just great men of this country, and a native Baltimorean, of course.
Yes, it was held over on at the West Democratic Club of Anne Arundel County Club Mead, and it was hosted by Joe Madison of Sirius XM's The Black Eagle. Yep. He gave the keynote address.
And I see Michael Mitchell, Perrin Mitchell's nephew, mm-hmm. there as well. Good man. Great. I mean, not enough honors for Perrin J. Mitchell. I mean, really, a man, he was a tough dude.
I believe he has a building named for him at College Park, doesn't he?
He did. He desegregated the College Park campus, much to the chagrin of Curly Bird.
Yes, H.C. Curly Bird.
Old Curly Bird. Yep. Man, Perrin Mitchell, great man, great man. And on that note, got to call it a day, Kamal. Kamal High is the managing editor of the Afro newspaper. Kamal, thank you.
Thank you, Sean. And once again, congratulations on being named Baltimore editor of the Afro.
Thank you, man. Thank you. We'll see you next week?
Sure, why not?
All right, good, good. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will be joined by Ashley Banks talking about some of her stories. Ashley is a correspondent for RT America, and she's host of Race in America for RT America. We'll join her. As well as J.K. Schmidt of the Afro. Stay tuned. You're listening to First Edition. I'm Sean Yost, your host, making the transition from the news directly from the pages of the Afro newspaper to the work of two journalists. Ashley Banks, news anchor and correspondent, host of Race in America for RT America, joins us. Ashley Banks, welcome back to WEAA.
Thank you so much, Sean. How are you doing?
I'm feeling pretty good. I'm feeling all right. Good to hear your voice.
Yes, thank you. I'm glad to hear yours as well.
Of course, of course, of course. First of all, I'm really, this story that you've been working on, I mean, I really could just take the entire time talking about this, the volatile racial climate in Lisbon, Portugal. First of all, how did you get wind of that story? How did that come to you?
Well, yeah, it's a funny thing. I was actually just traveling for vacation. I had wanted to see Portugal for some time. I liked to surf. I heard that they had a great coast to surf. And so I figured, hey, why not? I need a break. Let me go. And so last week, traveled to Portugal. And when I arrived to the city, I noticed it lacked those of African descent, being that the country is so close to the continent of Africa.
Right.
I thought it was very strange. Whenever I would see an Afro-Portuguese person, which was very rare, Sean, they looked like they were struggling as if they were poor and didn't come from much. Like I said, I was on vacation. So after a couple of days of seeing this, I decided, hey, I need to figure out what's going on here. I need to do some research because this is making me feel a bit uncomfortable.
Okay.
So after a few hours of research, I found that back in 1975, Portugal withdrew from 5 African colonies, including Angola, Mozambique, and Cape Verde. making Portugal one of the last European countries to abandon colonialism. Now, Sean, you're aware, obviously, that there's a bit of whitewashing in our history books here in America. Mm-hmm. But it's the same deal over in Portugal. Within the curriculum at Portuguese schools, they are learning that the Portuguese were explorers, not occupiers wow. of African countries, and that they didn't oppress Africans. They're basically saying that they mixed with local African people when that isn't the case at all. Now, Sean, white Portuguese, they moved to these five African countries, they took over, and they benefited from cheap labor off of African citizens. And we've heard this story plenty of times before, but this is totally new because most people don't know about this, including myself. So when the Portuguese did this, they changed the culture in these countries, making women straighten their hair, making men and women change their names, the language, and their customs. To this day, white Portuguese are still living in these African countries. They are living better than the Africans who were born and raised there. Now, here we are 42 years later, and Afro-Portuguese are suffering, mostly living in the northern part of the country, and that's why I wasn't able to see a lot of Afro-Portuguese, but they're living in the northern part of Portugal where they aren't living in great conditions, mostly poverty. They can't afford to attend college. They're victims of police brutality like African-Americans here in the U.S. And not just that, Sean, it would be rare to see a black doctor, a black professor, black people on television, or black people appearing in ads. So it's just like, utterly ridiculous that that's even a thing over there.
Well, let me ask you this, Ashley. Through your reporting, did you discover whether or not there is any political representation of Afro-Portuguese within the governing bodies of that city or that province? I mean, what is the political climate like? As far I can guess what it is, but I guess I want to just ask you for the record.
Right. No, not that I could see and not that I've researched. Like I said, I mean, that's definitely a rare thing if you were to see a black person holding a political office. But after doing some of my research, a lot of these African-Americans are victims of police brutality. So there's no one basically intervening on their behalf because there isn't anyone in that political office that can intervene on their behalf. These people are the minority in Portugal, so there's basically no one who cares enough to intervene. These people are poor. So of course, they can even hire lawyers if they wanted to. And most of them can't even attend or afford college, so they're not even educated enough to be able to help themselves. So at this point, right now, these people are just victims of these circumstances.
Interesting. You also did some reporting, Ashley, on the proposed nomination of Christopher Wray to be the next director of the FBI. We talked about that earlier in the week, but James Comey's testimony yesterday seemed to suck all the air out of the room as far as Washington, D.C. is concerned. What did you find out about Chris Wray?
Well, as we know, Trump tweeted that he would nominate Christopher Wray on Wednesday, just one day before Comey's public appearance in that hearing. But since 2005, Wray, he's been a partner at King & Spalding, which is important because it's the law firm that turns to for presidential appointments. Now, he usually oversees the special matters and government investigations practice. In addition to that, he was Governor Chris Christie's personal lawyer right. during the Bridgegate scandal. Right. Now, I'm sure that you remember that. So that took place back in 2013 when emails from two of Christie's allies revealed that lane closures on the George Washington Bridge had been intended as a political payback against a local mayor who refused to ensure Governor his reelection campaign. Now, Christie never faced any criminal charges, but many speculate it did damage his bid for president in 2016. Now, although, Sean, it doesn't appear that Wray supports a certain political party, I do want to mention that he has donated to Republican candidates in the past. He did not donate to Trump's campaign, but he did donate to Mitt Romney back in 2012, and he donated to John McCain back in 2008. But the biggest thing people want to ensure is that Wray will protect the borough's independence. Now, Wray's friends say he is more deliberate and low-key than James Comey and will remain independent. One of Wray's former judges, who hired him as a law clerk some years back, said he's not flashy, he's not showy, he's underrated. Attenberry will bring a more subtle management style to the FBI. Now, Sean, I also want to mention that Ray is what some consider to be a safe pick. Ray has never served in electoral politics, but has experience in both government and private law practice. Experts say that puts him more in line with previous FBI directors. Now, back in 2004, I want to state, Ray was the top criminal prosecutor when FBI Director Robert Mueller and Deputy Attorney General James Comey, they threatened to quit the Bush administration over a controversial surveillance program. He offered to join their protest, and this by itself gives the American people some sort of comfort knowing that he's being nominated, because it shows that he's not afraid to make a stance against political interference and would try to protect the borough's independence. And as we have seen time and time again when it comes to President Trump, he's tried to interject himself into criminal justice matters in ways that most presidents before him have avoided. As most are aware, his latest effort, of course, was to interject, was when he fired former Director James Comey in an effort to prevent the FBI from investigating his campaign and possible collusion with Russia.
Right.
Now, as we know, former FBI Director Robert Mueller is now overseeing the Russian investigation, and many say Ray and Mueller will work well together since they have a respect for one another. And we know that Ray, he's well known here in Washington. In 2001, he joined the Department of Justice as Associate Deputy Attorney General during the Bush administration, like I said earlier. And from 2003 to 2005, he served as Assistant Attorney General for the department's criminal division, where he played a vital role in the September 11th terrorist attacks by overseeing operations. Now, Sean, many speculate he will face questions at his confirmation hearing about what he knew about CIA abuses coming after the 9/11 attacks and how the DOJ responded to them. Now, the ACLU, they're calling on senators to specifically question Ray on the detainees and the unauthorized and inhumane treatment they faced at Gitmo. Now, if confirmed, we will see how Ray stacks up during that confirmation hearing. Usually an FBI director is confirmed by the Senate, a practice that has been in place since 1972. But now that Trump is president, and an unconventional president, to say the least, there's no doubt what will take place.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned the fact that, you know, FBI directors in particular are supposed to be almost really not what they're supposed to be, invisible when it comes to interactions with the executive branch, meaning the president of the United States. To that point, James Comey had two personal interactions with Barack Obama during the course of 8 years. One was by phone, and the other one, I believe, was in person. And the one that was by phone was just Barack Obama saying goodbye to him. In 4 months, James Comey interacted with Donald Trump 9 times, six times on the phone, 3 times in person. So to suggest that this is highly unusual would be an understatement.
Right.
We've never seen this before. It is unprecedented, the behavior of the 45th president of the United States in so many ways, but this is one of the most glaring.
I agree.
Quickly, Ashley, you also did some reporting on those horrific stabbings in the UK.
Yes, I did. Now, when I got word of that, I was on my way from Lisbon to London, and I was near some Britons, and they had told me an attack had just happened. John, I thought it was completely ridiculous, because an attack had just happened a week before with the Manchester bombing at the Ariana Grande concert. And
right.
I'm sure, as you know, Sean, usually countries are at their safest right after an attack.
True.
As security is heightened, you know, leaving a little room for a terrorist attack to take place. Now, I want to mention I lived in London a few years back, and let me tell you, it's one of the safest places I've ever been. Guns are illegal. However, knives, of course, are still around, but it's still much safer than living here in the States. I'll quickly recap what took place last Saturday. There were 3 terrorists. They drove a van into pedestrians on London Bridge on the evening of June 3rd. The terrorists got out of their van and started stabbing people in a busy market area, which was heavily populated since it was a Saturday night, of course. Now, according to media reports, the men were shouting, "This is for Allah," while wearing fake bomb belts to invoke. People in London are probably already terrified, because this is what now? The 4th terrorist attack that has happened this year.
Right.
So to wear these fake bomb belts, I mean, these terrorists are sick to basically actually they're trying to invoke more fear into these people that's already there. They're still trying to recover from the previous two or three attacks that have taken place. Luckily, the three attackers, they were shot and killed by London police shortly after the attack ensued. But unfortunately, as a result, eight people were killed. Dozens of others were injured as well. And Sean, I want to mention, two of these three assailants, they were known to authorities, which is becoming a reoccurring thing where authorities, whether they be in Europe or the U.S., they know who these people are. These people have been on their radar, yet somehow they're still able to pursue these attacks.
Indeed. And did you actually, so they caught all the attacks. No, all the attackers were killed, or were some of them captured?
Right. So the three, Kareem Budd, Rashid Rouhani, and Youssef Zakba, they were killed on scene. But police afterwards, they arrested about 17 people. Earlier this week, they released 13 of those people, and they captured another person. So right now, they have a total of four people in custody. They just captured one guy in East London. They believe that he is the one responsible for putting this attack together. I do want to mention as well, Sean, that all three of these attackers that were shot and killed that day, many are saying that they were radicalized by watching these propaganda videos from Islamic State. And not to mention, these people were actually, two of them were like British citizens. So they weren't just foreigners. I mean, some were born in different parts of the Middle East, but they were also citizens in Europe. And so for this to be able to be a thing right under, utterly ridiculous,
right,
to say the least.
Ashley Banks is a news anchor and correspondent of and host of Race in America for RT America. Ashley, so good to hear from you, and thank you for your reporting. We appreciate your time.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me, Sean.
Of course, of course. We're going to do a quick transition. When we come back, we will talk to the Afro's J.K. Schmidt about his story on the University of Maryland in the wake of the murder of Richard Collins. Stay tuned. You're listening to First Edition. Back to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I am Sean Yost, your host, making the transition from Ashley Banks to the reporting of Afro reporter J.K. Schmidt. We want to drill down a little bit deeper on his story about the University of Maryland. J.K. Schmidt, welcome to First Edition.
Well, thanks for having me. John's good. I'm only pretentious in print.
No. Hey, man, I try to honor what you want. If it's John on the mic and J.K. in print, then it's going to be John on the mic.
Perfect.
Okay. So, first of all, well, good work on this story, the follow-up to the murder of Richard Collins. Very clean writing, and I appreciate you going out to the campus and talking to people about how that campus is grappling with this tragedy.
Thanks.
Give me a sense, John, of the energy and the attitudes of the people that you talk to. I mean, from what I've heard, there's so much disappointment. When I posted this story, when it first happened, I heard so many replies from Black alum from the University of Maryland who are bitterly disappointed at not just the murder of this young man, but the reaction of the College Park administration. What did you find when you went out?
Well, disappointment is definitely the prevailing theme, or the, I guess, the returning idea when students, professors, and I guess graduates even at this point also, I guess, talk about what's happened. There was definitely distress over the delay. People were unhappy that they couldn't get a press release out until, I think it was Wednesday, after a murder that happened between, I guess, well, May 20th, which,
yeah,
I guess,
it was over the weekend,
right,
Saturday, early Saturday morning.
Beyond that, I guess there was certain, an anticipation that this was, I wouldn't say bound to happen, but there's been a history of, I guess, a lack of attention. At the beginning of the semester, UMD was presented 64 demands to represent just about every imaginable dimension. That's what's most impressive about it. It basically covered all of the underprivileged communities representing College Park. This is a Protect UMD, which is disappointed with the response to that. Beyond that, in 2011, a black student association presented to the administration at that point that there were serious concerns about how black labor was being treated on campus at that point,
right,
which is, from my personal experience being a student at Towson, usually indicative about what's about to happen next.
Hmm.
But does that answer your question?
Sure.
Okay.
But the point that we're trying to get at is that this didn't happen in a vacuum. And if we want to go even further, when you talk about create a historical context for the University of Maryland, I've reported in my column, and we've reported, also in the pages of the Afro newspaper, about the long history of segregation and intolerant behavior on that campus, and the most dominant, the most influential president of that school bears repeating, Curly Byrd, staunch segregationist, dyed-in-the-wool segregationist, and his legacy is one, I believe, that permeates many of the buildings, much of the atmosphere, much of the legacy of the school itself. So that cannot be swept away. Let me ask you about Wallace Lowe, the school's president, the first president of color at the school. When the initial release or a letter sent out by Lowe, to call it tepid, I think, would almost be a compliment to him. It was almost, it seemed even vague in some ways. I think somebody may have said something to him, and by Wednesday he came out with a more definitive statement. But still, basically it sounds like they want to continue to study the problem at the University of Maryland. And I think one of the things that may be so troubling and maddening to people is that there doesn't seem to be a that Lowe does. He seems to resist to want to say the University of Maryland has a problem. They have a serious problem with race and racism on that campus. And his resistance to saying that, publicly saying that, should be troubling to anybody it should be troubling to anybody, quite frankly.
Well, absolutely. It's an interesting crisis because when I think of, say, again, my personal experience with Towson, after, I guess, the white student union,
right, pretty much with the same thing.
With Heimbach, but like, right, the instances of racism there, but black enrollment and minority enrollment went up,
mm-hmm,
because this is where perhaps some action can be taken and things can be done to go forward. I don't want to put thoughts or to speak for Mr. Lowe, but I think the anticipation is that if College Park is presented as a place that is hostile to blackness or any other kind of vulnerable population, then those kind of enrollments will go down, and then naturally what is currently presented as the flagship institution of the University of Maryland system becomes...
But at the same time, he can't hide the fact that Richard Collins was murdered on his campus. So I hear what you're saying, but it is baffling that this first man of color to be president of the University of Maryland. Some people would argue, well, maybe it's not that baffling, but that's a whole other discussion. Maybe has just seemed to be trepidatious when it comes to dealing with this issue of race head on. Who did you talk to? You talked to some people of color on the campus, including students and professors.
Exactly. So let me see if I have at hand everyone's names.
Yannette Emanuel.
Exactly. She is a recent graduate as of May. So she has graduated. She had a degree in sociology. She was part of Protect UMB, representing the Black or African American Coalition. So she was part of the 64 demands. And is
some
also,
of them have been unresolved, right? Some of those demands still are unresolved, I believe.
Well, it depends on what your definition of resolved would be, because we're dealing with, I don't want to go too far, but we're dealing with a liberal institution. So a big part of that is going to be the quorum or the form, right? Hearing out the addressing of grievances,
right,
and then making a decision, right? And that theoretically is addressing the issue, right? Mm-hmm. Rather than say, I guess, resolving it to the satisfaction of the people that actually brought it forward.
That's fair.
So a lot of these issues have been addressed, and I'm sure that College Park is extremely...
Addressed to the satisfaction of Wallace Lowe, I guess.
Exactly my point, right? Right. That we addressed these issues. We didn't do anything substantively,
but we heard
you out, which often is, again, from my personal experience with other institutions, that's often what you're going to get.
Right. But one of the things that she said, I believe, or it may have been someone else, but they spoke of expulsion being on the table when these incidents occur, which has not been something that I've heard or seen coming out of the president's office, that a student who engages in racist activity, whether it be pasting flyers up on a wall or hanging a noose in a fraternity house, expulsion should be the remedy in the minds of probably many of the black people on that campus and other people of color on that campus. But I have not heard that or seen that as far as President Lowe is concerned.
Well, the five-point plan does not lay out any kind of consequences or any kind of punitive measures to speak of at all. There are no consequences listed. So the activist community definitely wants consequences. They have, as of... I want to say today, through the Fear the Turtle hashtag, published their response to demands, and going further than expulsion, they're actually asking for a zero-tolerance policy as well, which, like all policies, are difficult to navigate in practice. Like, I invite you to really, I guess, if you are a student or a professor, to talk about, say, the zero-tolerance policy for plagiarism, right, which is, zero-tolerance is an ideal, but... I can think of zero tolerance as policies, say, in the Baltimore City community, which are also not exactly productive or helpful or useful even. So they've laid out their groundwork. They have a plan or a vision as to what this would look like. The Lowe administration is still seemingly feeling this out.
What about in the most basic of terms, the safety of black people and people of color on that campus?
Well, the student that I put into the story, it says, well, he doesn't necessarily feel threatened, but as he admitted, he was a commuter, so he's safe for the brief duration that he's there during classes. I'm not entirely sure how you would protect that kind of space. When I went back, I remembered why I chose not to go to College Park the first time around. It is a huge, confounding campus to navigate. I don't know what pardon the visual, boots on the ground would look like. I don't know how you would enforce that with a bodily presence, especially since Lieutenant Collins was killed at a bus stop, right? Which is technically on campus, but in that weird...
Well, and then his assailant was hiding in bushes, allegedly. I still guess that gives no comfort to people on that campus feeling like they could be victims at any time. Of a deadly attack, literally.
Right. So I wouldn't say that it was obviously unsafe, but I don't know how you would, I guess, how you would physically intervene there, which I guess makes me a little bit more sympathetic to the college's theory that this is a war of ideas.
But at the same time, I believe part of Lowe's plan that he laid out did speak of safety and somehow beefing up, for lack of a better term, patrols on the campus. I don't know quite how that is going to look, to your point, but the reality is to be at an institution of higher learning and having a fear in the back of your mind or the front of your mind that you could be attacked, even if you're not physically attacked, that you are someone because of your ethnicity, that you're not the feeling, I would argue, that may be pervasive in some people of color on that campus is that you are not as valued as others on that campus. And unfortunately, I think in their minds, President Lowe's reaction hasn't necessarily changed that. I mean, I'm just saying. I mean, you were there. I have not been there, but I think that may be a safe bet to say.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's these ideas represent something more than they're not just words, right? That is the purpose of language, is to move people to do things,
sure.
Right? So when there are these chalkings, where are these signs entreating you to inform on your brown neighbors and turn them into ICE or wherever that phone number goes to on the flyer, I mean, I can't believe I'm saying this. Part of me actually hopes that it goes to ICE because at least they have rules, right? Because now I'm thinking, like, if it goes to a student, right, who knows what's going to happen with that case. But it's troubling that, like, when a woman can't go because she's Muslim uncovered down the street without being harassed by a frat house, right? That is a problem, even though it's just words. That's why there's assault and battery, right? Assault is verbal violence, right, threats and so on. And then in Lieutenant Collins' case, the battery and the death came later, right?
Indeed,
so.
Indeed. J.K. Schmidt is a reporter for the Afro newspaper. J.K., good reporting.
John, thank
you. Good reporting.
Thank
on
you.
This story.
Thanks a lot.
Appreciate you. Thank you. Yeah. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, second hour, first edition, world famous happy hour. Vangela will be here. House music diva. She's performing, I believe, this weekend. She's going to be in the studio with me and Patrick Scientific of the Audio Infusion. Then Patrick Scientific plays live. We got it all covered on the world famous happy hour. Stay tuned. You're listening to First Edition. We'll be right back.